Welcome to the Conversations Politics podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. Tuesday's budget was jam-packed with measures and there was plenty of pain for many sections of the community. It's going to be a hard sell for the government and it has given the opposition plenty of lines of attack. Matthias Cormann, the finance minister, and his Labour counterpart Tony Burke are in the front ranks of the battle. And they join us today. Matthias Cormann, obviously the argument about a breach of trust is raging. Can you clarify, is the government's position that it's not broken its election promises or that the budget emergency required it to break them?
The government last night delivered a very honest budget, a fair budget, and we believe a budget that kept faith with the commitments we made to the Australian people before the last election. The most fundamental commitment of all was that we would repair the budget mess that we've inherited from our predecessors and that we would again build a stronger, more prosperous, more resilient economy where everyone has the opportunity to get ahead.
Do you think it's likely that one or two of the bigger measures will fall foul of the Senate, or are you really hopeful of getting everything that matters?
Well, over the last 7 or 8 months, as we've worked hard on putting this budget together, as we've assessed the information in front of us about where we are and about where we would be heading without corrective action, assessed all of the options and made judgments that we believe are in the national interest. We've made decisions that we think are right. We now, of course, are in the process of explaining to people why we've made the judgments that we've made, and we're going to work with everyone in the Senate to persuade them that the plan that we've put on the table is the plan that Australia needs right now.
The odd wine with Clive Palmer, perhaps.
Well, you know, whatever it takes, as somebody would have said in the past.
It's been widely said that the government's pushing back of health and education spending onto the states is to get them to argue for the GST to be raised or broadened. Do you think they'll eventually come to that view?
Well, firstly, we will not initiate any changes to the GST, full stop, end of story. But what we are expecting the states to do, the same as we've had to do, is to ensure that their spending is as efficient and as well targeted as possible. The spending growth trajectory at a federal level that the previous government locked into the period beyond the forward estimate, so it wasn't immediately apparent to people as they went to the last election. But that was unaffordable, it was excessive, and it was not realistic. What we have done in this budget is put the funding growth trajectory on a more realistic, on a more affordable, and a more sustainable footing. The proposition that we are cutting spending is not right. We are continuing to increase our funding for health and education, but we are increasing it at a lower rate of growth because the growth rate that Labor had locked into the period beyond the forward estimates was not realistic.
Just on the GST, though, politicians are really afraid, in a sense, to talk about it. Surely they'll have to finally openly admit to the public that there are strong arguments for looking to change this tax and reap the benefits that that would bring more widely.
Well, the first thing that every level of government should do is to ensure that we spend taxpayers' dollars that we raise right now as wisely as possible, as efficiently as possible. And at a state level, the same as at a federal level, we need to ensure that we've got our house in order. And now, when it comes to our tax system into the future, we have already said that we would have a white paper tax review process that will get underway very soon. The states will have opportunity to put whatever proposition forward that they think is appropriate. But having said all of this, we would expect that the states and the territories do the same as what the federal government is doing right now, and that is look very carefully at our spending growth trajectory to make sure it is realistic and more sustainable into the future.
But in these health and education areas, surely putting such pressures on the states is making it tougher for two fraternal governments in particular in New South Wales and Victoria, which have elections coming up, to fight those campaigns. In Victoria, the coalition's on an absolute knife edge.
Well, I mean, this is not about politics. This is about what is good policy.
And schools, it is if you're having an election coming up.
Schools and hospitals are the responsibility of the states. It's states and territories that run schools and hospitals. The federal government does make a contribution, and that contribution will continue to grow, but it will not grow at the unsustainable and unrealistic rate that Labor had promised but never properly funded. I mean, the thing that we need to understand here is that the spending growth trajectory on the labour was taking us to a situation whereby 23-24 spending as a share of GDP was going to be 26.5% as a share of GDP compared to 23.1% in the last year of the Howard government. Now, all of that spending has to be raised in revenue. Now, all of that spending has to be raised in revenue. And, I mean, that is just not realistic that we would be able to get up to that sort of level when it comes to tax as a share of GDP and still be competitive in a global economy at the same time.
But the states would no doubt say that what you're doing is dealing with your problem by putting it onto them.
Well, that is, they might say that, but that is not right. What we are doing is we are asking everyone to contribute. We're asking everybody to do their bit. We're asking individuals, we're asking families, we're asking higher income earners, we're asking local government, state government, we're asking business, we're asking everybody to help build a stronger economy, help us repair the budget, because that is what we must do if we want to be in a stronger, more resilient position to face any challenge that might come our way in the future.
So you will and your colleagues will be having talks with the states about the details of this, how it all
well,
impact for them?
There's obviously an ongoing conversation always between the federal government and the states, and I'm sure that in the days and weeks and months ahead there'll be conversations about the implications for the states out of the federal budget, for sure.
Now, some of the harsher measures that you're imposing yourselves don't take effect until the next term. Do you think that will make it harder for you in the 2016 campaign? Do you think there'll still be election issues then, or will they be done and dusted and people will have accepted them?
Well, but this is where I'm saying this is a very honest budget, because we have transparently put on the table for everyone to see what we think is required in order to put Australia back onto a more sustainable footing. Now, obviously, in 2016, at the next federal election, people will have the opportunity to pass judgment on whether whether they think that we got this right, on whether they think that the budget that we put forward and the plan that we've put forward was fair. Now, you're quite right. Quite a number of the structural reforms and structural savings that we have initiated in this budget will start low and slow and will build over time. Some of them will only start in the period beyond the next election or even beyond the current forward estimates. But we are giving a very clear and very honest indication to the Australian people on where we think we need to head. And at the next election, people will be able to decide on whether they're happy for us to continue on that path or whether they would want the alternative.
You don't see it as a bit of the crazy brave there?
We see it as making judgments in the national interest and putting the case to the Australian people on what we all together need to do in order to strengthen our country.
Now, just finally, I know the government will have a lot more reform in the pipeline, but has this budget achieved enough savings to mean that you won't have to make major cuts in your second and third budgets, in the remaining budgets in this term? Well, obviously, there'll be housekeeping, but the major cutting has been done.
Well, this budget does contain a very significant first effort. There will have to be some more work in future budget updates and budgets. But over the forward estimates, we've implemented $36 billion worth of savings, taking the deficit that we've inherited, the projected deficits that we've inherited, down to $60 billion over the forward estimates. But obviously, moving forward, we do need to get the budget back into surplus, and we will do what needs to be done in order to achieve that. But a lot of the structural savings and the structural reforms will build up over time. So if you look at the trajectory beyond the forward estimates now, you can really see that we are on track to get into balance in 18-19, on track to get into surplus right now in 19-20, and where we're on track to reduce debt, which was heading for $667 billion down to $389 billion, even after taking future tax cuts into account to address bracket creep.
Matthias Cormann, thank you very much for talking with The Conversation.
Very good to talk to you.
Tony Burke, I know it's early, but what of the measures in this budget do you realistically think might be blocked in the Senate?
I don't know what will happen with the different parties, and so what we're responsible for is what Labor's position is. Obviously, Labor has a majority in neither House of Parliament, and we don't have the capacity to block. So the issue for us has been to prioritise what we believe are the most offensive parts of the budget, to make our position plain on those immediately, and then we'll gradually work through the different measures involved. So the three principles that we've been able to come out immediately on, where we think they are the worst of the broken promises and the worst issues for equity, are the changes to Medicare, the changes to pensions, and the changes to petrol taxes.
Now, you'll vote against all those?
Yes.
When you say the changes to pensions, are you talking about the raising of the pension age to 70, or are you talking about the foreshadowed toughening in the next term of eligibility criteria?
Both. We're talking about both. The criteria, well, not only that, the other issue with pensions, the other change, not criteria, but indexation. The change in indexation, they've gone harder than what the Commission of Audit even suggested they do. And what they've done with indexation effectively amounts to a cut in the pension. So we go from a situation where under the last government, under the Labor government, we had the highest structural increase in the pension in real terms that there's ever been, to a situation where the new government, and we can say next term, it's already in the budget papers as of now. It's been booked and it's in the documents now that they believe there should be year on year, every 6 months when it's time for indexation, a structural cut in the pension.
On the higher pension age, eventually the Coalition supported your move to 67 in 2023. This going to 70 would be 2035. That's a long way off. Wouldn't it be better to leave it to a later Labor Party to make a decision on whether that was appropriate?
The nature of the retirement age doesn't only go to what's happening with life expectancy. It also goes to the capacity to work. And for people in white-collar jobs like mine, I hope that I'll be able to work well past what would be a pensionable age. But
as a politician?
Oh, I wouldn't say no. I wouldn't say no, but there's a rather big interview panel every 3 years that makes that judgment call. For people in white-collar jobs, being able to work through the years is something that is quite realistic often. If you're in a blue-collar job where physical labour characterises the workplace, the retirement age can't just keep going up because people's bodies take a hit over the years. And so to say, well, there was a two-year increase foreshadowed under Labor, therefore every term of government we can keep increasing, the human body just doesn't work that way. And our view is very simple on this. The extra 2 years that were put on and phased in over a long time and brought in, I might add, at the same point that we gave a structural increase to the pension, is a world away from thinking every term you can just keep adding years to the retirement age. And what's worse, they're doing it at the exact same time that they're cutting the pension. We'll be opposing it.
Now, you're opposing the Medicare co-payment, but what's changed since Bob Hawke brought in a similar measure in the early 1990s?
Well, in terms of brought in, we don't have a co-payment. I presume you're referring to the pharmaceutical benefits.
No, he brought in a co-payment, but that was later scrapped.
Yeah. And what we have is a principle of universality that when other arguments have been put over the years, the universal health argument has always won, and won for good reasons. Not only has it been kept in place because of the principle that we all look after each other's health. There's the added equity issue that in families, people tend to get all sick at once. That's how it tends to be. So this is not a payment that gets staggered gradually over time. For people who are having trouble making ends meet with cost of living, these costs all tend to come within the same pay periods. But added to that, if the impact is, as it would most likely be, that for people on lower incomes, you end up avoiding going to the doctor when you should, the total cost to the health budget and to those individuals can only logically be more because they present later with serious illness.
How can you be critical of this big new research fund, medical research fund, that the government is setting up with the proceeds of the co-payment, though?
I don't think we've criticised money into medical research. We're critical of any principle that says the way of taxing people for medical research is on condition that they're sick. To say we're going to take sick people and they'll be the taxation method to fund future medical research is a perverse way of raising money.
Now, the opposition might be right in saying there's no budget emergency, but isn't the government correct in arguing that Labor pushed a lot of commitments, including in school funding, disability support, beyond the Ford estimates, creating a real funding problem in those outer years?
Well, every budget involves tough decisions. And the reason that we had a spending growth cap in place of 2%, we'd actually observed better than that, we'd observed 1.35 on average, but 2% was our growth cap for spending, was to make sure that each budget, as the new year came into the forward estimates, that you would make the tough decisions that were required to keep spending growth in control. They abolished that. That as soon as they came to office and they brought out the MIEFO, the mid-year document, Joe Hockey abolished the cap on spending growth. Now, it's no surprise, when you abolish the cap on spending growth, spending grows out of control. But the budget discipline that we had in place, if the new government had kept that in place, their claims about spending growth would not be able to be made. Yes, there are individual programs where for those individual programs, spending continues to rise. But all of that was public. All of that was public, and when it was public, Tony Abbott and Joe Hockey made commitments that they would honour it and that it was affordable.
One of the observations that was made during the Gillard government was that Labor was trying to Abbott-proof measures. But it looks as though that was a mission impossible, doesn't it?
Well, my view has always been the only way to protect people from the decisions of a Liberal government is to have a Labor government. I think it's as simple as that. And anyone who ever believes that you can lock reform in and it's impossible for a change of government to affect that, I think misunderstands what this government's willing to do.
Now, to win back power, Labor has to convince people it's a responsible economic manager. How does it tackle this task?
Well, the first thing is to be upfront and honest about the fact that every budget involves tough decisions. To acknowledge what the true state of the books were under Labor, not the distorted state that they ended up in after Joe Hockey doubled the deficit when he first came to office. And then we have to be responsible in our response and let people see from the way we respond to the budget what sort of priorities a Labor government would set.
And just finally, Tony Burke, does this budget give you greater hope that there's a chance this could be a one-term government?
The principle that we know now is the entire basis that Tony Abbott put to the Australian people as the reason for them to vote for him. And let's make no mistake, the biggest issue in that campaign from Tony Abbott was that people could take him as at his word. That is now in tatters. As you go through the key election promises, whether it be no new taxes, no cuts to health, education, changes to pensions, changes to the GST, cuts to the ABC or SBS, all of that was left in tatters by the end of the budget speech last night. Any claim to credibility or keeping commitments that Tony Abbott might have purported to have is now over. And that completely does change the dynamic in Australian politics.
Thanks very much, Tony Burke, Labor's finance spokesman. And that's all from the Politics Podcast today. Thanks to my producer, Matt Dawson. Talk to you again soon.